Welcome to the New Insight Podcast, where we interview the most important movers and shakers in ophthalmology and give you new insights on the innovations ahead. I'm your host, Viral Chef. My guest today is Praveen Dugal. Dr. Dugal has worn many hats in the retina space. He was managing partner at the Retina Consultants of Arizona and has been a clinical professor at USC Eye Institute Keck School of Medicine and is currently president at Iveric Bio, and we'll really dig into that latter role in the discussion today. He's really got an amazing background, and his journey is really fascinating. Dr. Dugal was born in Kathmandu, Nepal, grew up in Vienna, Austria, then attended the Harrow School in London, England, and finally graduated from Columbia University in New York, where very few people know this, but he was actually captain of the Columbia squash team. And ever since his childhood, he's been driven to help those suffering from vision loss, from family members that are close to him, to those on the Hopi and Pima Indian reservations, and ultimately at companies like Iveric Bio looking at to help the masses. In our conversation, we touch a lot on topics, including the work being done on geographic atrophy at Iveric Bio and the exciting times ahead in the space. We talk about Praveen's journey from clinician to entrepreneur to ultimately president at a high-impact pharma company. And we talk about the landscape ahead and how potentially the GA treatment approach evolves over time and get into a little bit about personalized medicine and where that takes us into the future. I've known Praveen for over 20 years, and I'm happy to give our listeners some insights into someone that has had so much impact in our community. So without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Praveen Dugal.
So Praveen, thank you for joining us today. It's always great to talk to you, always great to connect. And in particular, at this time when we've got lots of exciting things happening in our space, and in particular, with you and with Iveric and with what you guys have going on. So tell me a little bit about, let's start with background on Iveric, right? This is a company that, you know, I know very well, but the general retina population may not know. So tell us a little bit about the background and what you guys have been working on.
So, Viral, first of all, thank you for the opportunity. It's always great to talk with you, and it's great to talk about exciting things, like this. So Iveric Bio is a company that's gone through several iterations. You know, I started out looking into anti-VEGFs really for the first time in Macugen, if you remember. And then it looked at anti-PDGFs with Fovista, which was a big disappointment, unfortunately. And then that was a time when the company had different names. It was iTech, then it was OptoTech. And then after the Fovista disappointment, the company changed its name and really became a gene therapy company, and started licensing products with academic institutions like University of Pennsylvania, for instance, University of Florida, University of Massachusetts. At the same time, there was a trial that was ongoing. It was almost kind of running on its own. It was the ACP trial, was GATHER1. And when GATHER1 became positive, the company really changed very, very quickly to what is a therapeutic company now. To give an example, you know, when I left practice and joined here full time, which was 3 years ago, almost the week, this company barely had 20 people. It was trading at, I think the stock was trading just above two, at like $90 million valuation. It was about to be delisted from NASDAQ and be bankrupt, really. But there are some people here that just kept it going. There are a few people here that really formed the core of the company from the days when it was iTech and OptoTech, and they're still here. People like Keith Westby, for instance, and Glenn Smondorio, and others. Evelyn Harrison is another example, who really have kept this company together throughout it all. I just happened to be very fortunate to come at a moment when the study was positive, and we sort of morphed into who we are today.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you mentioned the GATHER1 study, and then really what's become the lead kind of molecule for you guys, Avacincaptad pegol or ACP. So tell us a little bit about that. So you mentioned GATHER1, now there's been GATHER2. So talk to us about a little bit about what we're looking at, what the targets are, and how you see that unfolding over the year ahead.
Well, from a biological point of view, the complement pathway has always been the logical target for inhibition, if you want to look at dry macular degeneration, for instance. And the question then becomes, and this is because of a lot of work that a lot of great people have done in the past. You know, you start out way back with the husband-wife team of Shirley Sarks and her husband, John, back in Australia, where they took meticulous pictures of patients and documented that, and then had the histology that could be examined. And Greg Hagman, whom I've known for decades since he was in USC and then Iowa and now in Utah, and all these people have done amazing pioneering work to really point to the fact that the complement has a very important role. Then the question became, you know, where in that pathway do you actually inhibit? And the way I look at the complement pathway, if you just kind of look at it, it looks very complicated. But what I like to say is that it's really more redundant than it is complicated. And redundancy in general is a sign of importance, both, you know, in life as well as in biology. It's no different than a pilot's cockpit, for instance. There are a lot of redundant switches there and so forth because it's so important, right? As you're flying, the same thing in the complement pathway. After all, it protects us against exogenous and endogenous pathogens. So it's a terribly important pathway. So you get three independent pathways, and I emphasize independent, that come together in C3 and then go to C5. And then from there, they become two systems that kill cells, the membrane attack complex and the inflammasome complex. So our view was, look, we want to keep as much of the complement pathway intact as possible. It's important to keep that C3 loop intact because it's very important for suppressing inflammation, for increasing activation, and so on and so forth. So C5 seemed like the biologically logical place to inhibit. And that's really how the whole Zamora story was born. It was really born from biology. And then obviously without having an animal model, with complement being species specific, the only way to really test that is in a human study. And fortunately, the phase 1 and phase 2 study was done and was successful. That led to the GATHER1 study being done, and that was successful, and then now GATHER2.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And so you were given priority review. So tell the listeners a little bit about that, because that's not something that you hear all the time.
Yeah, it actually was more than that. So, you know, when I came here, we had numerous collegial, very collaborative discussions with the FDA, but we had no formal meetings. And as I was telling you, we needed cash. And what was quite amazing is we did the first cash raise, when I got here, without having a formal meeting with the FDA. We had no paper to show people that we're actually a phase 3 company. And it was at that time that I called Dr. Chambers and spoke with him and said, we really do need to have a formal meeting, some formal documentation. And as the FDA has done with everybody, they've been incredibly supportive and collaborative. And from that point on, we applied for and received a SPA agreement, a special protocol assessment agreement based on GATHER2, because GATHER1 was already completed. And then once GATHER2 was complete and positive, we then applied for rolling submission, which allowed us to submit earlier. So we worked extremely hard to get that in. And we have a fantastic regulatory team here led by Sneh Shah. We actually got the clinical module in 60 days after the car turn, which is quite amazing. So we did rolling submissions. We got the entire NDA application in, and then we applied for breakthrough designation, and we received breakthrough designation, which we're very encouraged by. And now we have a submission acceptance letter from the FDA and are under review. So I think the entire journey and collaboration with the FDA has been nothing but extremely positive. So we're very excited as to the results of our review, but we're still undergoing that review now.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you walked us through that because, again, it's something that is not necessarily appreciated by providers that are not necessarily in tune with what's happening in the clinical trial world. So that's, I think that's important. And I think it speaks, you mentioned it, to the team, and you guys have an incredible team. I think that's really kind of helped drive things forward. Like you said, there were moments where you weren't really sure what was going to happen. And now those moments seem like a distant memory because I think right now it feels like sky's the limit. So that's really encouraging. So let's talk about that team for a second. You know, one of the things that's come up recently is you guys have put out really interesting and compelling vision data. And so I want to kind of bridge that with ARVO coming up. And so what are you guys going to be presenting? And maybe tell us a little bit about that vision data that you guys have really seen in from the data sets.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And thank you for asking that. Just a few words about the team. One of the really fortunate things about coming to a company that really doesn't have very many people and was you know, coming off a big failure is that you get to hire your own people and you get a blank slate. And we like to say, and we still say, that this is a company that's built by retina for retina. We really are a one-trick pony. We don't do anything else. We really don't know anything else but retina. And we like to say that we know everybody in retina, and we really do. And we've made a team based on that. We have fantastic people in this team. You know, Dhaval Desai, who really runs the medical side. We have Julie Clark, who also helps him. And we've got a great commercial team led by Chris Sims. So we really have extraordinary retina talent here. And so all of the things that we try to do is really based on their knowledge and their expertise and their experience. And we got together and we said at a certain point after the Gadadu Clark turn was positive, we said, you know, we not only have a unique drug, and for the reasons that I described from a biological point of view, we believe we've got a very unique drug. And the results show that. We also said we have a very unique patient population. Nobody's ever studied non-center involving patients before. And the reason we studied non-center involving patients was that one of the agreements with the FDA was that we would use visual acuity trends as a biomarker for safety. That's a pre-specified safety endpoint because the regulatory agencies wanted to see that the visual acuity trends were headed in the proper direction. In other words, the drug wasn't causing any loss of vision prematurely. And sure enough, both in GATHER 1 and GATHER 2, the visual acuity trends are heading in the proper direction, which is exactly what you hope to see. So for that reason, we enrolled patients who did not have central involvement. So based on that, we also said, look, it's unreasonable to think that we would improve vision by a lot. It's simply unreasonable because we're not claiming to grow photoreceptor cells. And once photoreceptor cells are dead, they're dead. But it's not unreasonable to ask, can we avoid severe persistent vision loss? And we used to do that. I mean, the anti-VEGFs really spoiled us, but we used to do that. For instance, if you look at how PDT was approved, if you look at how Macugen was approved, it was based on that. It was based on delay or avoidance of a doubling of the visual angle, which is 15 letters or three lines. And actually, that was approvable, still is approvable. So based on that, we did a post hoc analysis on a pre-specified endpoint, being visual acuity. And we were able to demonstrate, very much to our delight, that there was a delta up to 59%. So quite a big delta. The pool data showed a delta of 56%. And it's not just the absolute numbers in terms of the delta, and that's at 12 months, or the fact that the delta appears to be increasing over time as you would expect. But we were particularly delighted as to when that delta started. You didn't really have to wait for 2 years or more. It really started very early, after a few months. And that's really important because once you lose those photoreceptor cells, they never come back. And one of the things that I think is a challenge for us to educate the community about is, you know, people think that with DME, with RVO and wet AMD, that you need to treat right away. And you know, obviously you don't want to be waiting, but you can recover some function even after there's some fluid there. Whereas with GA, most people think, well, you can just kind of let that go for a while. And the fact of it is that it's not that it's an emergency, but with GA, you really don't want to be waiting too long if you can help it. Because again, once those photoreceptor cells go away, they never come back. And if you're a patient who's relying on a few islands, an island of photoreceptor cells to not trip over chairs and burn your hand on the stove, every one of those cells matters. So the fact that that separation occurred early was very encouraging to us. And what we will present at ARVO is more of that information. We really want to be identified as a drug that improves function and has the visual acuity benefits. We will be layering more and more information regarding function in other meetings as well, starting with ARVO. We will show numerous sensitivity analyses to show that it's not just 15 letters, but this occurs at different thresholds as well. And then in the other meetings, you will hear us talk more about the layering of function on that. So the bottom line of this is that I think what we've done for the first time is to close that loop between structure and function. The regulatory agencies have always said that function will follow structure, but it takes a while. And we've proven them correct. And indeed, for the first time ever, I think anybody has been able to show a functional benefit with a drug that will decrease the growth of geographic atrophy.
Yeah, and it's going to help us as clinicians, right? I mean, we're still figuring out how to position these treatments, how to talk to our patients, how to educate our referring physicians and what the expectations should be. And I think the more type of data that we have that supports, you know, functional improvements or functional change and improvement in the history and the path for that patient, I think is going to be critically important in how we message. So let me shift gears for a second. You had mentioned kind of how you, you know, how you came into just Iveric at a certain time, at a specific time when things were, you know, kind of heading in one direction and then kind of went completely in the other direction. So that's amazing. And you were, I think, named the board in January. Is that right?
Yeah, that's
so right. Congratulations on that. And I think from me, when I see that, you know, it begs the question of, you know, what got you there? What, you know, caused you to, and, you know, work as a clinician, start working with industry? When did that collaboration start and how did it develop into kind of what it is today?
Yeah. So, you know, you won't remember any of these because you're probably in middle school. I'm old, so I can tell you this. You know, when I started out, I really went the absolute traditional academic route. I mean, I was in academics for a couple of years. You know, my mentors were phenomenal. You know, Steve Ryan was my mentor, Ron Smith, Don Gass, Lawrence Zimmerman, people like that who I looked up to. And what I also realized at that time, again, a lot of the young people like you didn't live through that, is that there really wasn't a whole bunch that we could do for patients with macular degeneration. And I have a family history of macular degeneration. You know, my parents have it, my grandparents have it, so that was a personal connection for me. And if you can believe this, one of the standards of care was to actually laser the fovea in patients. That was really the standard of care after some trials were done, because the scotoma would be smaller than if you just let the neovascular membrane grow. I mean, we were at that extent. And then came PDT, and this was the first time really that industry had ever come in other than in surgery where Alcon and BNL were there. And we really had no idea how to handle that. Glaucoma was ahead of us, the anterior segment people were ahead of us, but there was no way to do that in academics at that time. And it was a little bit frustrating for me. So, you know, I left and I thought, you know, what I will do is to create the best and biggest academic private practice center there is. And I literally looked at the demographics and saw that in Phoenix, there were the least amount of retina specialists. And that's the only reason I went to Phoenix. I had no connection there at all. And I struggled mightily for 10 years, got absolutely nowhere, but gradually started building a practice that did lots of clinical trials. The practice got bigger and bigger. We then became fairly entrepreneurial in having several businesses outside the practice. We spun off, I think, 11 or 12 companies. We had, for instance, an aviation company. We had two planes and five pilots. So we had a vitamin company. We had a real estate company with several ASCs, things like that. And then came the opportunity to really sell that. And we did. And at that point, I was at a point where I said, you know, I really want to do something completely different. And I'm fascinated with new drugs that have the potential to come in, but I want to learn from the other side. And when this opportunity came, you know, my motivation here was to learn the business end of it. So I deliberately do not a whole bunch on the medical side. You know, there are people like, you know, Davol and Julie who take care of that. I probably spend 90-95% of my time on the business side. It's a brand new learning experience for me. It's absolutely fantastic. I mean, this is the best job I've ever had at this, you know, at the proper time. And it's like going to medical school all over again. You know, if you remember the joy of learning when you're in college or medical school, where you go, wow, this is great. I can't believe I'm learning something new here and there. That happens to me every hour of every day. And it's a whole new network of people you meet. It's a whole new skill you learn. And it's fascinating and it's absolutely phenomenal. I can't tell you how happy I am to be where I am, but again, it's all about timing. I loved where I was, you know, when I was in practice, also when I was in academics, but the timing is such that for me, this is exactly the right place to be at this point.
You know, so for those of us that train fellows, I mean, we're starting to see more and more that, a lot of the trainees are looking for less traditional clinical routes. I think they want some of that in their practice, but they want to kind of broaden their horizons, look outside of just the day-to-day clinical practice. So for those that are kind of in the process now, because to your point, the landscape has changed, right? I mean, when you were starting out, you know, there weren't a lot of clinical trials going on. And today it's much different and there's lots of companies out there. So if you could give one or two pieces of sort of pearls for these new kind of graduates, what would you tell them? What should they do to kind of, one, get maybe some exposure to that, but also to start building those relationships?
You know, two things. You know, one is just, you know, dream big. I think is think the opportunity is endless. You know, this is, we are behind, we're so far behind fields like oncology and rheumatology, where there's an established route for people that are in, that are clinicians, who are clinicians that want to be in industry. There are pathways to go and so on and so forth that are fairly mature. We have nothing but opportunity. You can carve your own path. You can do whatever it is that you want to do, you know, in terms of liaising with industry. Some people have done it part-time. Some people have done it sort of on the side. You know, I never was bright enough to do it part-time. I figured if I didn't do it full-time, I'd never learn it. So, you know, I sort of cut the cord and came full-time, but there's so many ways that one can interact with industry and there's so much opportunity. So that's one. The second thing, which sounds easy, but maybe the hardest thing to do for us from a psychological point of view, is just never be afraid to fail. You know, we are extraordinarily risk averse by nature and by training, and you kind of have to be. I mean, you don't want a surgeon who's going to not be risk averse. You know, that's probably not the kind of surgeon you want. So it's good to be conservative. It's good to be risk averse. That's who we are, and that's how we're trained. And, you know, we are taught from the time that you know, we're in middle school or something, the next step and the next step and the next step. It's very difficult to be in a position where you sort of cut the cord and decide to do something very different where there is no next step. That's no. If there's a quality I have, it's that I've really never been afraid to fail. And there've been so many, and I failed so many times. And, you know, as I said, when I left academics, you know, there were a lot of people that thought that was the stupidest thing in the world. And maybe it was at that time. And I got literally nowhere for 10 years. But it is very important to realize, if you're going to take new steps, if you're going to go down a path that hasn't been created, it's not going to be a linear path. You know, there are going to be ups and downs. The good thing is there are lots and lots of people that are out there to help you. It's a very close community we have. We have a great community, and I've always had people help me, and there'll be always people out there to help. So, yeah, dream big and don't be afraid to fail. I mean, my favorite quote of all time really is the only way to guarantee success is to fail more. And I really believe that.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. And I think you're right. You use the word community. I think there is really a community that exists amongst retina specialists. And I think leveraging that, I think, is really an important pathway forward. So, all right, I'm going to, you know, we're going to close things out soon, but I want to bring it back to geographic atrophy for a second. So what, you know, let's say ACP Zamora is approved later this year. How do you see things playing out in a world where a year ago we had nothing, right? And in, you know, in a few months, we may have two options and then maybe more along the way. So what do you see playing out and how do you see that unfolding over the next maybe year or 2 years?
It's a great question. You know, look, what we know about the pathophysiology of macular degeneration is that it's not a bifurcation. It's not a fork in the road as we used to think years ago. We used to think that as we got older, you know, we came to a fork in the road and people either got dry macular degeneration or wet macular degeneration. Now what we know is that it's a singular highway, right? It starts from one drusen and ends up all the way to advanced geographic atrophy affecting the fovea. And that entire process is a wound healing process. And in any wound healing process, there's going to be interplay between angiogenesis and inflammation. There has to be. If you get a paper cut, you're going to get redness, you're going to get swelling, you can get blood. You have to have capillary dilation. You have to have angiogenesis in order to bring the inflammatory cells to their target. Now, when in this wound healing process, the needle turns a little bit more towards angiogenesis, you get what we call wet macular degeneration. And then we treat that with anti-VEGFs. And it's a detour that gets you back on the highway. And we know this because patients with wet macular degeneration who are on treatment with anti-VEGFs, as you well know, rarely re-bleed. They end up going blind because of geographic atrophy. So having said that, if you've got something to treat macular degeneration, it affects the entire pathway of macular degeneration, wet and dry. My biggest concern with geographic atrophy and complement inhibition was, are we treating too late? The goal here really is to have version 2 and maybe even version 3 where we can go to treat earlier and earlier in intermediate macular degeneration, for instance. Now, it's not sustainable in the form that it is right now when you have early macular degeneration to have people come in on a monthly basis, but it will be sustainable if you have a sustained delivery device, for instance, where you may have to come in only once every 6 months or once a year, you know, as you would go for a teeth cleaning. I think ultimately this disease is going to be a spectacular example of treatment and avoidance of blindness. I really believe that. And I think it also is going to be the ultimate in personalized medicine. I think we're going to have genetic diagnostics. I think we're going to have AI. I think we're going to have a brand new set of biomarkers as well as a brand new set of imaging modalities. I think it's going to be the ultimate in personalized medicine. We're seeing the very first version here. This is not the last version. This just opens the door. And for this version, I think to be successful, we have to understand that. And secondly, we have to have a language of communication with the patients, which I think we've hopefully provided with avoidance of severe persistent visual loss. And thirdly, I think we have to really own that patient experience. I think we have to make this experience as easy for the patient as possible, as understandable as possible. And look, that's what we endeavor to do. And that's the expertise that we have. As I keep saying, this is the only company that's made by retina for retina. So we understand, you know, how the patient experience is inside out, because a lot of us have been on the other side. So we'll come up with a way to make this as seamless as possible, as good for patients as possible, and we'll work as hard as we can to get version 2 out as well.
Yeah, no, that's exciting. And I think, you know, to your point, I don't know if we really can predict 2 years from now, 3 years from now, how we will be practicing, especially in terms of geographic atrophy. Are we, you know, what's the treatment schedule going to be? How are we going to be following these patients up? Are we going to be leveraging things like home OCT? Because, you know, there's this big debate right now. How do we manage the patient volume, right? Or do new, longer, more durable treatment options, whether it's for GA or other diseases we manage, help kind of offset that? So it's going to be an interesting kind of period where in the next few years, things are going to change dramatically, and a lot of it by necessity, right? So, you know, to that point, you know, if you look at 3 years from now, let's say we got that all figured out. Let's say we're managing our GA patients well. We've got some new treatments available for neovascular AMD, DME, whatever it may be. What 3 years from now is still a huge unmet need? You know, for the longest time, we've been talking about GA as really the prime unmet need in our space. Let's say 3 years from now, we've kind of figured that algorithm out. What is the unmet need that's left 3-4 years from now?
You know, I think it's personalized medicine. In every in every aspect of what we do. Look, the anti-VEGFs are fantastic, right? But I remember, again, because I'm old, being the very first anti-VEGF advisory board ever. And I could have sworn, as you know, many of my friends did at that time, that we're just on the brink of having 3, 4, 5 different drugs with, you know, affecting different targets, because you can't possibly have a situation where in a disease that complex, it's only the VEGF pathway. I mean, it's just not possible. And yet we don't have anything. And after 30 years, that's all we have. Still, now they're better and better without a doubt, but that's all we have, right? And we treat everybody the same way. And clearly people respond differently. You know that being a clinician, that's why we have treat and extend, but we can't figure out who's going to respond how, right? Why should that be any different for dry macular degeneration or DME or anything else? You know, I think what we will, the thing that we're really lacking really is we're lacking biomarkers that will allow us to personalize our treatment in everything, not just GA, but in everything. We have one biomarker that just by unbelievable serendipity happens to be the perfect biomarker for anti-VEGFs. I mean, again, I remember when Zeiss first came out with OCTs, it was really designed to pick up macular holes. And everybody kind of laughed and said, you know, I don't need this to pick up a macular hole. Why would I spend that much money? I can do a 90 diopter exam and I can pick up a macular hole. And then anti-VEGFs came and suddenly it was like, wow, this is perfect. I mean, it was a marriage made in heaven just by accident. And it happens to be the perfect biomarker. In fact, the biomarker is so good that there we don't have another biomarker. And, you know, if you look at faricimab, for instance, how would you know the anti-Ang2 is doing anything? There is no biomarker, but there is one for the anti-VEGF part. So I think we have a real dearth of biomarkers, and we will have them. It doesn't necessarily have to be machines. It could be biomarkers of anatomy, for instance. There are some great people doing fantastic work based on that. It'd be artificial intelligence that we would layer into that. And ultimately, and genetics as well. And ultimately, with all these modalities, I think what we'll be able to do is say, okay, based on your genotype, based on your biomarkers, and based on anatomy, you know, based on AI, this is how you're likely to respond. And this is the best way to treat you. And I think that applies not just for dry macular degeneration, but for all the chronic diseases we treat.
Yeah. No, fantastic. I think, Praveen, this has been an amazing conversation. I'm sure we will do it again soon at some point. I want to thank you for your time, and thank you for the insights into Iveric and into kind of the year ahead. So very much appreciate your time.
It's always a pleasure to talk to a dear friend, and thank you for the opportunity. It's really been fun.
Thanks again for joining the New Insight podcast and spending your time with us today. Be sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listing or watching platform. And if you're interested in more ophthalmology news or other podcasts, visit hcplive.com and check out our offerings. For now, I'm Dr. Viral Sheth. Hope to see you next time to discuss what's new in sight.